Melancholy.
You've got the most amazing handwriting. I've been looking at it, I'm well impressed.
17th century, mirror writing.
Yeah.
If you work at the museum long enough.
Okay, you know. I think we better start.
Right.
Now I'd like to introduce Hannah Hodach, who is leading the second session today.
Yeah, and I'll do like Felicia, I'll do a short introduction and then we'll move on. And I think this first session worked really well, so I think if we can just keep it going. Don't sort of there's fruit here and sandwiches for anyone. So in the second session we're going to discuss marketing sales for and off goods brought to Europe by the East Indian companies. And I'll take the opportunity here to tell you a little bit very briefly about some of the research we've done on this particular aspect. But I think it's first worth saying more generally that there's not that much done on sales and market of East Indian goods. Just talking to James Thomas here over lunch about what he's been working on, but also there's classical works, other classical works by Moy and Moy, The Management of Monopoly, Tea Studies and Shop and Shopkeeping and so on. But I don't think it's wrong to say that we generally don't know that much about what happened once the goods had been brought to London or Orient or Nantes or Copenhagen or Göteborg or the ports of the Dutch Republic. We don't know very much about the purchasers and particularly the wholesalers in cotton and silk and porcelain, and what the relationship between them and the wholesalers and the companies, and the relationship between the wholesalers and the companies looked like in the different companies. Maybe we know most about the English company here, but not so much about the others. And how much the wholesalers, for example, influenced the orders and ultimately the production of goods in the East. Now, one type of material that can illuminate these questions is the orders that went from the European headquarters to the factories in China and India. And in the project, we started off, we worked in the British Library for, well, some of us stayed for a week, some of us stayed for a few days, looked at the letter containing orders that was sent off from London, specifying what representatives of, in this case, the English East India Company, wanted their representatives in India and China to buy, to purchase. And reading between the lines, as well as reading these documents as well as a little bit in between the lines, it's possible, I think, to actually talk a bit more about, to see the market and how the market influenced the orders of. And in the English East India Company's case, it's kind of very specific. They talk about the European market. They're very general, but they definitely put a location, a geography on it. And we found comments which reveal the market's reactions to qualities and of previous years' cargoes, for example, on textiles, whether they were evenly enough woven or if they were finely enough printed, or whether the dimensions were the right ones, the width and the length. And added to that, when you read these order letters, there's also this constant demand. This is repeated year after year. We want more patterns. We want more colours. And that's something that we've been thinking a bit more about. So I have just a little case study that we've done on the Swedish East India Company. Because if what you can do, you can match these order books with other sources. So this is a sales catalogue from the Swedish East India Company from 1748. And it gives us the prices as well as the names of the purchasers, but the prices of different lots of silk, Meuble Damask from Canton. And this is around 5,000 pieces that are sold, or 4,310 pieces to be more specific. And these pieces, they were sold in lots of between 30 and 38 pieces. And only this data alone sort of suggests or give you an impression of, well, you would assume that wholesalers would be the main purchasers of these goods. But we can also see another tendency. For example, as this example demonstrates, the lots of silk fabrics sold for different prices depending on the amount of variation of colours that were in the different packages. So here I've taken two different examples, the same quality, Meuble Damask, same sort of dimensions. But as you can see, that lot which contained 31 pieces in 16 different colours sold for a higher price, a substantially higher price, than the lot that only contained 6 colours, but all in all 37 pieces. So the more variation, the higher price is maybe one way to try and summarise this type of work, or at least the hypothesis. And we are hoping to explore these sort of issues more in the project, and we're working on it. We recently found, when we went, me and Micah, here we went to James Ford Bell Library, I think I've been telling everybody about it, and we studied this great archive from a Scottish merchant, but what we also found was a sales catalogue from 1772 to 1774, again containing the prices of goods that they were sold for, we assume, and the name of the purchasers. And I don't know how familiar you are with the source material, but sales catalogues are a bit hard to come by. The English East India Company, there's surprisingly few left. I think if you look in their catalogue in the British Library, the last one that's listed there is from the early 1730s. But we're hoping to find more from these English East India Company. If you just to give you an example of what this material looked like for anyone who's not familiar, if you change slide again, Michael. This again, you can see how very sort of careful listing of bundles of fabric with numbers of pieces and colours, different qualities. And if you change again, so this is the French sales catalogues. This is 2 years, and this little Mac, this big Mac laptop that's in the corner there, if you want to have the proportions, but they're this size and this thick. So it's a, you know, they're the big sales catalog, and I think it's also worth comparing. If you go the next, this is an English East India Company sales catalog from 1675, so 100 years earlier on from the French that we just saw, and it's all in all 10 pages listing the fabric for sale brought back to London in 16 ships. So just to sort of, the catalogues becomes more and more sort of rich, and they also, of course, this also illustrate how the goods was become more and more diversified. I would also here like to sort of underline that we're not only interested in finished goods, like but also in goods that could be refined. And anyone who read or knew or knows about the East India companies knows that they imported mother of pearl, raw silk, rattan, for example. And these materials were used to build furniture. And expensive toys and produce mixed textile fabrics, and how the movement of material from Asia to Europe triggered the development of new goods in Europe helps to illuminate one of the sort of founding, the main points of our project, which is to link the import from Asia with production in Europe, and particularly the Industrial Revolution and what happened in Britain. One important starting point for a discussion of the market and the wholesaling of East Indian goods in Europe is, we believe, also the fact that the East Indian companies operated in very different, under very different circumstances. The Dutch and the French and the English companies did have a much stronger domestic market than, arguably, I'm talking to Mikkel about this, the Danish, but definitely the Swedish. Because the domestic market did hardly exist in Sweden. The great majority of the goods imported by the Scandinavian companies, and I'm talking at least in the Swedish case, with sometimes up to 90% of the cargo was re-exported. And a lot of this cargo, of course, we know, was tea that was then smuggled to Britain. And this re-export is not something that only sort of, of course, characterized Scandinavian companies. A lot of the great Atlantic world was the receiver of a lot of sort of East Asian goods too. So stripped and checked Indian cloth, the Guinea cloth was brought to West Africa and then became part of the slave trade. And luxury goods, sort of porcelain dinner sets, were brought over to the West Indies to enrich the life of the European planters. So there's a much wider sort of dimension to this re-export. But just keeping it to Europe for a little while, and this is just some last-minute frantic way of trying to summarise 2 weeks in the archive with Micah and with Charles Irvine. Here's a map where I've been trying to highlight the most important person that Charles Irvine was in contact with while managing the re-export of goods from Göteborg to different parts of Europe. Now, Irvine was a supercargo that worked for the Swedish East India Company from the very beginning, and he went to China a few times, but he most of the time he was in Göteborg, sort of conducting and this trade. And trawling for his archive, he discovered how Irvine established contact with a wide range of wholesalers in Europe who bought the goods that were for sale in Göteborg in the 1730s. This is mainly 1730s, 40s and 50s. So as you can see, a lot of it is tea going to Hamburg, Amsterdam and Rotterdam. But there's also a fair amount of silk fabrics and cotton silk fabric and porcelain that goes to the continent. Another interesting affair that went on for quite a few years go back to the map, thanks. was that Irvine was engaged in importing cotton, in Indian cotton fabrics, that was sold by the English East India Company in London. So he was part of exporting that from London and then on to Stockholm, where that it was sold by Anders Plomgren, who was also engaged in the Swedish East India Company.
May I?
Yeah.
Is this the private trade of Irvine or company trade?
Good point. Both. Irvine was, and this is something we talked about a lot, Mike and me, because I think we both thought, wow, he obviously had private trade. In the Swedish case, you had certain amount of space allotted to you that you could use. This was then changed for privilege money, but that sometimes in the 50s. Never mind. But it's very clear that added to that, Irvine, and we think, because if you look in the sales catalogue from 48, for example, it's Campbell that's the most frequent buyer. Irvine and Campbell were this. And it seems to be that they bought a lot of the company goods and then passed it on to the wholesalers, or sold it on to wholesalers, or asked wholesalers to sell it for them in Rotterdam and Amsterdam. Now, reading this, and again, this is based on a very sort of very general reading, sort of snapshots here and there of letters, because we had a lot of letters. It seems to be the case that these wholesalers, when they communicate with Irvine and, about this, that they think about the market as a European market. You know, we haven't come across any big discussions about differences in terms of geographies or national differences of tastes and so on. But of course, this is something we really like to explore further, because we do believe there must have been differences. So this sort of brings us to some of our questions for this sessions that we would like to address, which has to do with differences, different types of market. What was the role of the re-export and informal modes of distribution of local and specialized markets? For local and specialised markets in Europe, and as you said, Anja, that the difference private trade, company trade, are the differences here? Were there national differences in taste and markets, or were these class-based and therefore pan-European? Maybe or pan-European. What is the role of fashion? Did the marketing of Asian luxury goods work differently from one continent to another? Have you underestimated the role of private trade for the creation of a European market for Asian luxuries? And how did quality control work more generally? So with these questions, but I mean, feel free to relate to the topic of sales and market more generally, but these are some of the questions we had in mind when we put together this session. Okay. Anyone who wants to start?
Can I ask you a question on your...
The map.
Yes, because that's new for us too. We've looked at some of them lists, ordering lists, and then so we haven't had a chance to talk about this yet. But what I wonder, very simply, with the re-exporters, how did they manage? Because a lot of these would have had just mercantilist rules against just freely importing stuff. So how did they? Because the things that I know that came in kind of privately but in France or the tea in Britain, that was all smuggled, but that doesn't seem to be particularly kind of undercover. So.
Yeah, I think Leo mentioned for some period, silk, for example, was banned from being imported to Sweden. During some periods, it was okay, but it was a high duty put on it. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but the way that the sales were organised and the duties for import and export, not export, for import, were organised was very much to encourage the re-export. In fact, I think, isn't it like buyers who come from abroad, they cut the price for the half a percent or a percent just to encourage...
Yeah, see, that was the same as France. They encouraged re-export. But if this guy re-exported it to France, which didn't allow... lots of textiles and lots of silks in.
Yeah.
How did he get it in?
I think then you have smuggling as an alternative.
But if he officially gets Guillaume Groom to do that, how does Guillaume
Groom... Well, officially it might be a bit strong. So this is the trade that Irvine is conducting using both privately imported goods, pakodil goods, as well as company goods that he and his companion Campbell are buying in the auctions in Göteborg. And I think then, I mean, there's a lot of smuggling going on. So we can trace, there's some very, very illuminating letters where he lists sort of captains and names of people who are engaged in this, in receiving tea and bringing tea over to Scotland.
But can I just come into that point? I think that even though we think of closed mercantile systems, it's not just smuggling. I mean, obviously goods can come in, they're just heavily taxed.
Right?
So it's not that you can't trade.
Yeah.
It's just that you have to, you know,
tax. Yeah.
And so those and Bordeaux and Somado and La Rochelle, they had all these merchant houses from, you know, Scandinavia or
And
it's not that they can't trade, so I just wanted to say that.
I think Mikkel and then Andrew.
It goes very well, because the point I wanted to make was also, it's true that France also to lift up that decent civil shipping industry, of course, had fairly closed borders. But it could obtain passes, royal passes. They were always issued royal passes for imports. And those royal passes are actually kept in the French National Archives. I'm not, well, you know better than I, but they are extremely difficult to work in the French National Archives. but there's also written books on this. So you could obtain these passports. It has also to do with the thing you had on your list of questions, I think, and now we're entering more a realm of the cultural analysis in this. It has very much to do with the fact that in France, in one way, they used the invention, you could say, of the modern fashion industry in order to protect the home industry, especially lace and silk. We all know that the Lyon factories, etc., the royal courts, at least the Queen and her ladies in waiting, each year changes all their surfaces in order to keep up, and it's a new kind of fabric or a new kind of pattern, etc., in order to keep up the brand. But nevertheless, in order to keep Lyon at its toes, they actually also used strategically these imports on royal permission of silks and of cottons and of calicoes, etc., to keep this, you could say, this machine on fashion at the Royal French Court and therefore also at other courts in Europe running, basically in order to keep our own industry. But we need this kind of, and it has been, I can't remember her name, but there's one of my French colleagues, as you told us, who has done exactly this work, and I'm referring her right now, and I'll find her when I get home.
Pass on the reference.
Yes.
Thanks
very
much.
Would be great.
Yeah. I think Andrew?
I didn't think I had anything to see in this particular section, but what struck me about that map was that genuinely shows how the Swedish East India Company and the English East India Company are in some senses conjoined entities.
Yeah.
Because effectively what you have is Clifford and Sons in Amsterdam in the 10s, 20s, 30s and 40s are one of the major suppliers of silver for the English East India Company in London. They're one of the agents that the company uses in the Amsterdam silver markets. Ochterlony in London, meanwhile, is underwriting. Everybody that takes a job in the English East India Company has to have security. You've got to give it to the director. I've found that he is in exactly this period got security with the Leadenhall Street in well over £2,000 for any number of Scots employed as supercargos on the cotton and silk trades. So here is a guy who's buying in Swedish material, or sorry, sending material to Sweden, that is also behind the scenes a major player in English East India Company, as is Gifford. But these guys clearly don't see themselves as operating in just the English company, or for that matter, in the Swedish. These are guys that act as the grease in between the two operations. In a sense, they're kind of, the companies are fretted at the edges and sort of coming together. But in the 20s and 30s, Gifford and Co. were huge operators, but they're buying Swedish goods. That must mean your idea of them as pan-European agents specialising in all dimensions of the European-Asia trades is definitely, you're onto a winner for that.
Yeah, and later on, Clifford and Sons in the 60s and 70s become the company's agent in Amsterdam and supply commercial intelligence on a weekly basis, the price currents and all the rest of it. So they command information
yeah.
which they then clearly redeploy
yeah.
in private yeah. sense as well.
Mike, I've picked up those letters too. I think it's yeah. the same with handbills from the... Yeah. from. Sorry, Mike, maybe you want to...
But I think, you know, this is maybe one way of thinking about the double or the multiple functions any of these actors had within the network. So Octonom not only secured ships that were, that went to Aberdeen and got with smuggled goods on them. He partly insured them in the legal things that were on board. But he also, he engaged in a huge amount of very trivial tasks. So he was the writer of Charter and cared for his repairs and sent stuff for his personal use from London. He did in a huge amount of things. He bought privileged space, from different people who was John Irving, so another nephew of Charles Irving, who was a supercargo in Canton. He bought space from him and from others. So there were always buyers of company goods engaging in privileged trade, and having all these roles at the same time. They could shift over the time of their careers. They could shift because there were new opportunities that opened up. And what we saw in the archive was just, it's not easy to pin down if somebody is a broker, if somebody is a wholesaler, if somebody is an insurer, because they're engaging in all sorts of things.
Just a footnote on Yorkshire's talk to Lorne, because it's stunning also, I think, he's stunning, but maybe not surprising, but he writes very clearly, as soon as the conditions for tea trade change, the Swedish company is going down the drain. Very well aware of that. And he also says, and these Swedes, they don't seem to be that good at manufacturing, in contrast to the British. So he has this sort of interesting insight.
But perhaps you were also able in your material, I don't know, just a suggestion, perhaps you were able to follow also not only the multitudinous things they do, but it could also be a kind of career. At least we know in the Danish context, and there are several other, not the biggest merchant houses, but the average level of merchant houses, they are founded by people who started their career as young men in the companies, and then they kind of gain their general market knowledge and how to do things and networks and whatnot. And then they set up a true merchant house on their own, and then their son are usually a success. So it lasts for these general two, three generations, as merchant houses do. Perhaps you're able to follow such careers, because that could be a way of getting into what you also mentioned before lunch, getting into see these kinds of roles and of ways of creating markets.
I think there's definitely a trend which I think other people have recognised too, that they go from trading with goods to trading with insurances and more immaterial stuff and taking commissions, taking less risks, I think, to a certain extent, because they're not depending on the goods being of high quality or low quality.
The examples we have are actually the other way around. Mm-hmm. They go from having a nice position in the company, being whatever they are, civil servants or even cargoes in China, and then they get home and then they take the full risk themselves.
Andrew, did you have something?
No, I
think just to not to...
I'm sorry, I'm a bit my mind is not functioning well. I wanted to ask, because I'm hearing so much, so I'm losing track of what I wanted to say. You said something about the what we call in Dutch the eisen, which are the orders for the goods that the company wants. Can you match it with what they supply? Because I know from the Dutch case that they keep on ordering many different commodities, but they are not always supplied. Mm. So they keep on ordering until it becomes clear that they can't supply. Can you match your...
Can I let Chris answer that question? Because I think
maybe better to go to do the statistical thing. I can briefly say, you can link that up, and sometimes they don't supply, but there's also cases where they simply supply what they're asked. So there's a game going on there between ordering things and getting things, that's for sure. But I think people are in general too dismissive of these lists as just being guesswork by people in Holland, because if you look at the way they evolve, they are not very specific in the beginning, and they get more and more specific, as Hannah said, so that seems to indicate that while it would be a bit weird if you would send an order and you're not getting it, and then you make them more specific, more specific, more specific, and over 200 years you're not getting it. I don't know. Of course there are goods that are not supplied, but I think this is actually a game that we should study more in detail, what is supplied and what is not supplied. And I think the ordering lists are a good way into that.
No, because I know there are goods that they want, like in our case, porcelain, and they couldn't get it because of the Ming Qing turnover. So, but they wanted porcelain. Mm. So they kept demanding porcelain, and then they would find different suppliers. Mm. Okay, we will leave that. In the Dutch case, there are very few the records of the sales,
okay. Left
because yes. They use the documents as cannon fodder in the last century, so we know very little. We do have the general auctions, mm-hmm. but you don't get detailed information of the goods. So you might have they are selling cloth or porcelain or whatever to a certain person. They do mention the buyers,
okay.
But that's it.
Okay. Do they mention prices too?
For the bulk,
yeah. So and we're talking about sort of the what sort of size of bulks? You know, are you talking about all the fabric brought in that year, or are you talking about all?
No, what the person buys.
What the person buy? Okay.
In our case, we also have the shipping list mentioned in the newspapers. Mm. So we have Hollandse Mercurius. Mm. It's a newspaper. I've never looked at it, but I know someone used it and published some data, and they will contain the cargo of the East India ships, because our records are not complete. Mm. So, you know, you have to find your data from many different places. But you could also we also have newspapers that record the sales, the Amsterdamse Courant. And I think a lady worked on it for textiles, but I'm not sure.
All right.
So I will check.
Yes, do please.
but I don't know if she's still alive, because this was a long time ago.
Yeah.
But people keep referring to her, thank you to Mrs. Whoever for supplying me with the data. So the data are still in the Amsterdamse, the newspaper, Amsterdamse Courant. Mm. And they list what was sold in shops or wherever in Amsterdam.
Yeah.
These are advertisements.
Yes.
In terms of quality control on the British side, that point about matching what actually comes in response to the requisition, I think can be followed quite well, actually, because you will be able to document the receipt of the cargo or the consignment, the checking of it, and then the supplementary comment back to India or Canton, almost marking the proficiency with which these goods have been gathered. And there are numerous examples of consignments being sent back because they've either been badly packaged and become water damaged. The whole issue of rubbish teas is an ongoing sore, where they will quite routinely send back 400 chests of tea because they've been filled with stones and sticks and dust and all the rest of it. And you can follow the dialogue backwards and forwards. And that raises a very interesting question about what the incentive or penalty is imposed upon the agents, as the company agents in Asia, to actually meet the commodity specifications. Because as you say, it could be that these are just ignored and anything is sent back, but my sense is that there is over time quite a tightening of the gap between what they want and actually get. It's quite a sophisticated system with incentives built into it. And I think that's best followed, or most conveniently followed, through the Fort William India House correspondence, where instead of having to look at the E4 series, you can simply use the indexes there to follow backwards and forwards the instruction, the response, and so on. So it's a cycle for each consignment that runs over perhaps four or five voyages, actually, where the comment and feedback, and particularly interesting there is that those commodities that come under the heading of experiment. They will often ask for that which we are customarily inclined to request from you, but we have a sense that these commodities might sell well in London, and therefore we wish you to procure, if you can, yellow flowered patterned, whatever it might be. And you get a lot of commentary on that as well. And my sense throughout is that the company quite rigidly sticks to its core consignments that it knows that will sell, and then at the margins is experimenting a lot with different types of quality textiles and so on. But it also runs across other commodities, indigo, you know, and all the rest of it. It's quite a sophisticated process. And then you can follow through in the E1 and E2 series, the dialogue that they have with either merchants in London or people who are clearly purchasing the stuff to get feedback on all of that.
Yeah.
Mm.
Thank you.
And we've got, I think, Pernilla.
Pernilla on the mic. Yeah, sorry, Pernilla. Mm. Yep.
I have two points. Just to add what you said about the newspapers in Holland, you have the same in French newspapers from 1759 as one called the Journal du Commerce, but it's published in Holland, but it's French goods.
Yeah.
And then the Gazette du Commerce from 1763 started to publish these. But then I was thinking about, you know, looking at, you asked about, you know, the demand and supply of goods and how that links into taste, and have we ever been able to compare these, and have there been shifts in taste? There's a historian, Philippe Audrey, who studied the French East India companies, and he's done a little study, or published a book where he compares the different East India companies. And he speaks in there, and I don't know what sources he uses or where he's got his information from, but it's quite sort of a thin study, but he speaks about there being different tastes in Europe, and he says, I can't exactly remember what it is, but some places they want green tea, for instance, and they want different kinds of tea in different parts of Europe. And I don't know how he got that kind of information, but I was thinking, and I know Eric probably will know more about this, then the Sonton Register, which shows the, you know, the goods going in and out of the Baltic, must have that kind of information, like sort of whether we can trace over time the sort of the change in demands and from where they, you know, they were.
No, good book. Maybe Eric, would you like to expand a bit on
a
the
a few words on the sounds of resistance? You have to be very serious now, because the sounds of resistance are on UNESCO's list of the World Heritage. There's a list called Memory of the World, and the sounds of resistance are on that list, which we are very proud of. And that's, of course, because they are very interesting, these Sonton registers. The Sonton was introduced in 1429, and it was dissolved in 1857. So it's a very long series of several hundred years. And from around 1557 to 1857, that's exactly 300 years, we have an unbroken series of these records, which record all ships that sailed into the Baltic or came out of the Baltic. And from the mid-17th century, we have in those records, Soundtoll registers, information also about the cargoes, in addition to the name of the master and the date and his home port, his port of departure, and his port of destination. Then we have information about the cargoes. But these colonial commodities are not always specified in the Sonton registers. Sometimes it will just say colonial commodities worth 2,000 rix dollars or something like that. But in other cases, you will see that there were so many pounds of tea boy, so many pounds of green tea, and so on and so forth. But it's an enormous volume of information. It's almost 2 million ships passengers we're talking about here. And it's a little difficult to work with, but thanks to our Dutch colleagues who have financed a very huge project, we are right now
creating a database with the complete information from all these almost 2 million ships passengers. And for the time being, the second half of the 18th century is available on the net. And if you want the address, it's www.soundtol.nl. And there we are creating this database, but besides, there are scanned pictures of the original registers, and they are complete by now. So, and the database part of it is increasing and increasing and increasing. So by now it's a little more than 300,000 ships passages from the second half of the 18th century, which are, is available in the shape of a database on the internet. And you can search for a specific commodity there.
Wow. Yeah. Amazing.
Anybody would do that with the French. Not ever put anything online.
It was 15 years last time I looked, so they have expanded it to half a century. That's great. No, because I did search.
And it will all be finished, I think, in a little more than a year.
Wow.
1.5 years.
Amazing. Yeah. How many people do you have working on that?
Well, it's about 30, 40 people that are typing this information into the computer.
Yes.
If you look at that webpage, there's actually pictures of the room where they're working. It's kind of amazing to see it all sort of laid out and how they must.
It's an industry. I call it the Soundtol industry.
No, and I remember I searched, I tried, it was 15 years when I just sampled and wrote in China, and then you got the China ware and you got China silk and so on. But but there is a problem in so far. Isn't it also the case that these descriptions are based on the reports of the officials that took them down on trust from the captains? They did sometimes testing a few, but generally they're not based on...
That's right. The Soundtol registers are created on the basis of bills of lading and things like that. Official documents that were presented by the master to the customs authorities in Elsinore.
Yeah.
But on certain circumstances, they went aboard the ship and had a closer look. Yeah. Especially when Scotsmen
are. It would be very difficult to tell what flag the Scotsman was flying under, I suspect.
They're just listening.
But I should also say that the shape of the website, or the homepage now, is rather primitive, you might say. But as time goes on, it will, the database will increase, and the facilities that are attached to it when it comes to statistics and ways of searching and so on, will be improved over the next 2 years.
Thanks. Well, if anyone wants to add anything about Soundtol, Mike, it was on the list, and then Maxine, you raised your hands.
Can I just interject at one point? It's worth bearing in mind, I think, we talked about the disparity between the orders going out and the attempt to fulfil the orders from the Oriental. It's worth bearing, worth bearing in mind, I think, that even when they set off what's been ordered, it doesn't follow that all of that arrived, for example, in London, Gothenburg, or wherever. Because some of it fell off the ship on the way.
Yeah.
In some cases, quite blatantly.
Yeah.
So it's just an added dimension to bear in mind.
Yes, I noted that because me and Mikey found references to sales in Cadiz on the way back, offloading Chinese silk and selling in Cadiz.
So there was a racket that went on in Falmouth Harbour for about 30 years, between about the 1730s and 1760s, where they were just blatantly tossing cargo over the side and removing it to avoid paying any form of duty.
Yeah, the same in Lorient.
It got to London and ended up in companies' warehouses, there was no guarantee it was going to be there to be sold when the company wanted to sell it. Because some of the company employees, if you look at the Old Bailey reports, were actually wanting it to disappear.
There isn't...
If it was anything in direct connection to that, otherwise I think we have Mike again.
No worries, I was carried away by the soundtrack, so...
No, mine is a very minor comment, but just... having been to the Museum of the Docklands, they've got a lovely reconstruction of what happens on the dock side as the ships are unloaded. And I know would this have happened in the 18th century, the 17th century, but goods were taken off the ship, they put it in the bonded warehouses, but some crates were sampled, and there are these fantastic photographs of the 1920s of sample rooms full of porcelain, full of ostrich feathers, full of sponges. That must have happened in the 17th and 18th century, and if they do have them, then do those lists survive? Because that's where quality, presumably, is being checked.
The warehouse records for the warehouse committee records got jettisoned by the East India Company. Tons of stuff in the customs records of their lockers, who basically stand over the people doing the sampling to make sure that they're doing it right. However, the problem is the lockers and the people working on the East India Company employees are all fee-taking officers, potentially all out on the make as well. Yes. So there's this huge problem with actually taking seriously what's going on. What is happening for sure is that the upper echelons of the customs and the upper echelons of the East India Company, not people in the warehouses, are having almost perpetual dialogue about what they're doing right and wrong. Yeah. And counting all of this stuff, looking at all of this stuff, taking the correct samples, and there is just untold amounts of detail about what they should be doing, how they should be taking things out of bales. You know,
a qualitative discussion of quality, and that seems to be it. So are there equivalents of that in for France? For
can I just ask what sort of, is it? All sorts of goods, or is it mainly tea, or what?
It depends on the fortunes of the company a lot, what seems to be in under the political spotlight. So in the 1780s, tea is the big thing. Private trade, there is sadly not a lot written about that. Silks, because there's usually various disputes with various manufacturing interests about silks, that crops up occasionally as well. It's quite unsystematic, but there's quite a lot in the customs record about that. I guess the other thing that's interesting about this is that they're not sure who is right about the counting. Should it be the company who know their own interests, is the idea, or is it the customs who know best about how to tax things? And the customs actually say, no, we're not the best people to be taking these samples. The merchants should be taking the samples because they will make better samples, better judgments of it. They know they're great, they have this kind of idea of what the market is. And there's this one fantastic bit of correspondence that actually the customs themselves, when they seize goods and say, well, you haven't paid the right tax on that, they then have auctions four times a year themselves, and they say, well, we should get company merchants in to draw up the lots rather than our guys who don't know anything about all of this stuff. So it there's a whole kind of politics going on underneath this.
With quality, early in the 17th century, when the records are less well developed, there are still discussions about quality in the court minutes and that sort of thing. Particularly indigo is an issue in the 1630s, and it goes back and forth and sent to various different groups to test the indigo and to try and clarify what good indigo is in comparison to bad indigo. And these discussions continue for month after month after month within the court minutes, so you can, it's less statistical, but you can track sort of how changing attitudes affect commodities.
Just add to that, there's an interesting bit of archaeological evidence that the East India Company warehouses in Bishopsgate and in the silver keeping district had special skylights fitted so they could check the quality of the indigo. Sadly, they got taken out in the 1860s, I think, when they had another story onto the warehouses, what's abandoned it, but there was a quite physical aspect of what it is in very specific places.
But you're back to personal knowledge, and that's perhaps what you could try to find, and then speak your sources, the only place where you can really find that, especially in the earlier cases, is if you come across, or so lucky to come across, either memoirs or letters or something. I think I told you yesterday that the story from the private merchant has a bit like that one, and they got their tea, the father who had served in China, he had 200 cups. And he had made 200 cups of tea, and then he tasted all of them, and then he made his price register.
Yes.
But it comes back to to the knowledge really of what the tactile knowledge of what you were doing. And then there was also to that except memoirs or letters.
That's something I'm quite interested in, how the knowledge gets, how you create something like a general expertise, because you have to spread it outwards for people to buy it as well. I mean, you have to kind of obviously know something about lacquer if you buy it in China, and then the wholesale merchant needs to know it as well, but then if you're a retailer, you need to know it as well. And after a while, when it becomes fashionable, as a general public, you want to know about it. And what I find quite interesting is the treatises that are about, that people must have bought about this, and then you have in a, I wonder, a dissertation upon tea that's, I think, 1750s. And I said that to my students to meet, and they said, who bought it? And I think you really, and that has a long kind of chemical analysis of what chemicals you put into the cup of tea to see whether it has the right colour, whether it's been coloured and all that. So I think in what changed over the course of the 18th century is that you have an active search by publishers to spread knowledge into the public sphere, to judge quality, so that everybody could judge quality. You have the Dictionnaire du Commerce and all these publications in France as well.
Let's hit Mikey first and then Andrew.
Oh, all right. Okay. So, well, I actually have one, but I don't know if it's a good idea if I go back to that point.
Okay.
Was you going to point about the experiments that the company tries to make on the margins of the commodity composition of the order? And, I mean, the very simple debate that is, you know, that is usually going on in the literature that distinguishes private trade strategies from company strategies is that the company, and I assume that's the case in not only for the English but other companies as well, they do standardize and they do tend to eliminate most of the commodities towards the end of the 18th century and have less variety really. Concentrate on those who they know they have a fixed profit on them. And on the other hand, the private traders are those who are more willing to engage in speculation and, you know, bring in more goods. But I'm just thinking about, I mean, if that's so easy, or because these supercargoes and captains, you know, on the spot, they have this double function. They do need to find new goods or profitable things for the company and for themselves. And, you know, I'm just thinking about if we could talk a bit more about the dynamics, like who's actually forging tastes or who's actually, you know, making the first step of what to bring in new. Is that maybe also the company, or is that only private trade, or what is the dynamic there?
Good question. I think Andrew first. Maxime, what's the response to this?
Well, I just want to draw some of the discussion to the retail side, because this is where it is, I mean, it's the crucial, you can produce all the most beautiful stuff in the world that you want, but the really difficult thing is selling it. As we know, I mean, we had our Indian craftsmen out at the Ashmolean producing beautiful stuff. But the problem is, how do you find the contacts in Europe who are going to sell this stuff? It has not changed. It's the big question for these luxury producers. But it's also, for the people who want the stuff, how do they get precisely what they want? And I think it might be helpful to try to compare some of this discussion of the uncertainties and the difficulties of this kind of market with the supplying of the colonial American markets, and where we don't have companies, etc. We've got all these private traders and merchants, etc. But those wholesalers and indeed retailers in the American colonies, they knew precisely what they wanted. They were absolutely demanding and discriminating, the groups that I looked at, they dealt with very specific, ideally, they never couldn't always do this, but ideally with small, well, indeed, some of the ones who operated at the best level, they traveled back and forth, they knew the London season and the fashions, they could get the up-to-the-minute patterns and fashions for those highly discriminating North American consumers. I mean, that was kind of the cutting-edge market, was supplying these people. It wasn't, these were not customers for the leftovers. Well, one part of my question is, you know, supplying these Asian goods to these consumers. We haven't talked at all about this group of consumers, these those inhabitants of the American colonies. So, because they're, that's a different group of people. And but these wholesalers and retailers, they knew their specific suppliers in London, their specific manufacturers, or they went, you know, to others in Birmingham and Sheffield or what, wherever they were picking up the various goods for them. Absolute clear lines of distribution to all these groups. Now, it's a bit more difficult to do that in Asia, where you have all these, you don't know your producers. Like, I mean, you've got to deal through all these uncertain agents, etc. But we get all these, one, you know, in these order books, these, we don't want any dirty, muddy greens anymore. Send us bright colors and lots of nice patterns, but not I don't know how specific these patterns are set out. Can't they can't be quite so clear as those in those North American orders of European goods. I think it would be good to have some conversation on just how far these wholesalers, retailers could go with exactly what they could demand, or are they just bringing in, I mean, there's this experiment, let's bring in some of these patterns and see what happens. Can we dictate them? Of course, we know they're sending out models and musters, etc. But just how specific does it get? So, I mean, I'll just throw that open.
Okay, Giorgio, Mr. Andrew first is in response.
I was just going to say, in terms of the question of taste and markets and who's driving it, by way of kind of coming at it from a different line, we're all assuming demand and the active desire for any Asian good. But the only time I have ever laughed out loud in the reading rooms in the British Library, it's the only time I've ever done it, was when I read how extreme people could get in fighting Asian goods. Because I came across this example in 1711 where merchant tailor apprentices, and honestly I am not joking, are caught, were caught for dipping weasels in turpentine, setting them on fire and throwing them over the company's dock houses to set fire to the cotton. So I was reading this going, what? In other words, one of the ways you might be able to work out who are at least perceived to be the drivers of the new markets and arbiters in taste, whatever it is, is to look which groups are attacking them. Now, this is not to get into the whole debate over luxury, etc. Yeah. But certainly there are a couple of examples from the Scottish records of tea retailers being attacked. Yes. And you know, because by brewers, etc., because they're deeming to be taking people away from good wholesome beer to tea. In other words, one of the ways you might work out who are at least perceived to be the people who are at the edge of from wholesale to retail to consumption is to find out who is attacking them and who is actually saying, because these people were presumably informed enough to know market conditions that if they take out shop X or company dock Y, they obviously feel in terms of who's driving taste. Is it the East India Company, at least for these merchant tailor apprentices.
How informed can they be if they think weasels are a good way of...
It was brilliant, because the weasels are still alive for a while, so they run around the wheels. That's what happens. No, but the weasel's still alive when they set fire to it. It then obviously runs around in a considerable amount of anxiety and set fire to the bales. So it's actually quite a sort of an odd way of doing it, but in that sense, they seem quite...
consolation, the weasel practice wasn't peculiar to London. The crossbar workers in Portsmouth were forbidden to dip live rats in turpentine and set fire to them.
This is clearly
quite a strategy.
To go back to your point about driving passion, I think it's worth bearing in mind that those people on the end of the selling chain, people like Edward Eagleton selling his tea through 27 outlets across the country, inserted in local newspapers very cunningly worded advertisements about forthcoming sales, in which, amongst other things, for example, he said, "I'm perfectly prepared to have the tea done up in half pound and pound packages that will meet family requirements." So it's almost as though he's triggering off in people's minds the idea, "I must go and get some tea," because the other side of the point is that they were thinking about Andrew's point about who was attacking them. There were people who thought drinking tea was immoral. And certainly not to be done on Sundays.
So we have a Giorgio and then Leos and then Chris. And anyone else? So?
I wonder, following Maxine's advice, we might try to decompose what we mean by equality, in the sense that there are several different terms that are used there. You use fashion, you use quality, you use taste. They're all highly different terms. My research on textiles point out the problem of variety is what people are asking. There is no fashion in terms of what we consider as fashion. There is no yearly cycle, for sure. Something that emerges in silk. So it really depends also on the specific commodity. For instance, if you're talking about silk, I would say that then the idea of fashion becomes quite central. Creating taste is not necessarily a creation of fashion. Variety remains again a big problem, especially in the American market that Maxime was mentioning earlier, in which they seem to want the entire range of variety of what is available in London. They're very keen for that, and this is why they tend to gather an enormous amount of information what is available there, and they want the same kind of palette also in the colonial environment.
Leos and Chris.
I think also this with shaping taste, the shaping of fashion, and actually the question on how the European consumers could be supplied by substitute made products are of course crucial for this project and also for the relations between with trade relations. The focus, when we look at the construction or shaping fashion, is on manufactured products. It's on cottons, it's on silks, manufacture, furnitures, and so on, lacquerers, which are things that we still have often in museums and so on. We can look and then we can study the production techniques and we can look at them as manufactured objects. It's much more difficult with consumable goods like tea. So, and I think it's important point to make distinction with these two things, because it makes us to think in different ways about consumable goods. But there were also manufactured in a way. It's very obvious with sugar, but of course sugar is not so, it's not really big in Asian trade. But of course even when we look at tea, so it was produced as a kind of commodity, and there is a, when we're talking about finding substitutes in textiles and manufacturing of textiles in Europe or China in Europe. So it's very obvious. But I mean, the same strategy was used also for consumable goods. So not least for tea. I mean, tea was introduced to India, to Sri Lanka, by, I guess, Kenya is one of the biggest tea producers today. And it's related to that the creation of consumable commodities.
And all the different qualities and
taste for drinking
different teas at different types of the times of the day and all that, yeah.
I mean, the one thing is to look at the sale part, markets in England and so on, and newspapers and looking at how retailing was done. But of course, we can find also a lot specific information in a correspondence. You know, the people from Gothenburg were ordering very specific kinds of cheese. Because they expected, they had knowledge of market in Europe. They knew that, this moment, Bohé is not going so well, and they were shifting to Haisan or Suchang to other kinds. So, and again, when we talk about cotton, so it's so obvious that we have so huge variety of colors and. But similar things also is in the consumable goods. Yeah. Perhaps not so huge variety, but it's there.
Yes.
And it is discussed. So Chris, and then John, and then Anja. Yeah.
Well, I just want to take it to Asia, because the person I studied did do trade with Batavia on behalf of French trade, and he sent over these cloths to Batavia to sell it to the Scheepsvinger, which are the people taking it to Europe, so they're taking it in private trade to a certain extent, that falls in what Michael was saying. And what is actually quite fascinating to see is that sometimes these goods became very successful, but then the company would step in and say, well, you're not allowed to conduct a trade in this item anymore, this specific cotton, and they would just regulate it. And then, actually, if you look at what he sends, he stopped sending those kinds of cotton. So they had a way to enforce even private traders to stop trading in certain goods at the root. He just has to stop. And you can follow those regulations sometimes, not always. You can follow those regulations and see what they excluded and included. So there is, even at that level, a game going on from what they want to have for their own company trade and for what they can do as a private trade.
Yeah.
Sorry. I'll put you on the list, having John and then Anjana and then.
He's skipping back and forth, but so responding to George's point and also Maxine's point about variety, and I think this has triggered something in my mind about textiles and varieties of, because in Hamilton papers, and bear with me, but the Hamilton papers in the museum, I think we saw that when your students came down last year, this manuscript obviously, but one of the manuscripts is actually a pattern book, and you sort of open it out and it keeps opening out, you know, and it's impossible to display, but it's actually a pattern book showing cottons that have been sold from Manchester to Asia, been brought to Asia, so it's a slightly different point, but I'm just thinking about if you're going to try and package something up, rather than writing a list of this is a printed cotton, this is yellow pattern, whatever, they actually produce these little pattern books, and if they produce one, well, they produce lots of them, obviously, to use on different legs of the journey and market it, so I suspect it's something that's been there for a lot longer, and of course they're all priced individually on the back. So I don't know if that's something that
we have found loads of references to pattern books, both being sent out and being brought home, but very few in the archives we've been looking for.
They get worn out. They're used so much, they get destroyed in the process. Yeah. It's like designs, I mean, the same thing. They get actually, because they are so used, they're not just being sent to one person and then kept, they're being shuttling backwards and forwards, so they get destroyed, I assume.
And I wonder if there's a difference between the samples that almost, that you still have. Like, there's still a couple of samples around. There's some in the British Library, there's some in French archives, where you just have a bit of the fabric for silk or for colours. And whether that's different to something that they make up in Europe on the basis of what they got sent, and then send it to Asia and say, we call this number one, we call this number two. And those we haven't found. I don't know if the difference is clear. One is almost like sent information to say, this is kind of, you know, different colours that we can do or something. But there must be, I mean, there are clear references to samples that they have in Asia, that Europe has at some point sent to Asia for fabric, but also found it for fans and we found it for porcelains, where they say this, we want, you know, we sent you A, B, C, D, we found that actually when you send us A, it's rubbish, so only send us B and C, and don't worry about D because that's too expensive or something.
Yeah.
They have that.
I've done it.
That is around. But we don't
I was wondering if your team is looking at the shift of focus of the various companies from profits from trade to profits from taxation. Mm-hmm. Of course, there is all the commodities keep shifting. Mm-hmm. Everything begins as a luxury product, mm-hmm. ends up like, you know, tea is drunk mm-hmm. by the poorest of the poor in London in 18th century, while the olive of sugar, tea, pepper, all of these would mm-hmm. be very luxurious commodities. So the commodities change from luxury to Primark level rating. And I was wondering, how does that play with the shift of the companies in Asia from profits from trade of different commodities to profit from taxation? I was wondering, I've always wanted to know, and maybe Maxine can answer it now, why was Surat not declared a presidency town and Bombay became a presidency town? Because, you know, Surat had all the textile, all the networks, all the agency, all the, you know, but it's Bombay that is declared a presidency town.
Sorry?
Yeah. As far as I'm
aware. You can ask Tim, he works on that.
Thesis, go on.
How long have we got? there was a number of factors, but I mean, Bombay's got a hugely more convenient harbour than Surat. In fact, the running into Surat silted up all the time was an absolute nightmare. So it was partly all those kind of, I don't know, almost maritime concerns, but also geopolitical concerns, where it was located on the coast, as well as all those things we've been talking about as well. So it's kind of difficult to come back.
So basically, your trading networks also change your because of geopolitical factors and not just because of markets and availability of products.
Yeah.
So that's probably something to.
And also the strength of the Indian and other private merchants, Portuguese and others in Surat. Surely that must have played a big part. Because the dominance of the English is very much more contested there.
Mm-hmm.
The one
there
place that was their own centre,
yes,
that they could really build into
a
British hub.
Yes,
yeah.
That's right. Yes, Guido.
Yeah,
yes,
I think the geopolitical factor is really important in this, because in Surat, the English were always under the authority of the Mughals, whereas in Bombay, Bombay became transferred to the company, it was really a place where they could set up under their own jurisdiction this colonial settlement. And it was the same time in the 60s that Surat was a few times overrun by Shivaji's Maratha forces. So there was much more feeling of lesser safety of persons and goods in Surat at that point, on top of the always sort of frustrations on the part of the British with the Mughal governors that in Surat that they perceived as sometimes being arbitrary. So I think that the political factors are the most important in this issue. Because if you see the presidency towns, you call them all later Madras and Calcutta. So it's all towns that the British either have, like Madras, leased at first and then really become sort of de facto owner of, or have founded themselves, like in Calcutta. So I think that is very important. And in Surat, they never had this this influence politically.
Yeah.
Right, we have two on the list now. We have Gerrit and Gerrit and Sylvia. So, yes.
Okay. Yeah, well, I would like to say a little bit about quality and variety and possibility to steer upon those factors from Amsterdam or London or whatever. I think we should not think that whenever these companies are coming in Asia, that, like in the case of Canton, they are trading off the ship. It's not the captains, and often also not the cargoes, who are on board of those ships. No, the order goes to the man who is locally in charge. Mm-hmm. And he has one season, probably mm-hmm. 1 year, to collect all those things. So then we are not talking any longer with people who know about prices in Europe or qualities in Europe, but civil servant type people. Well, a kind of a colonial administrator, Zamala Letty. To line up with your idea of taxation, which becomes more important than trade, well, if you look to the Dutch case, which was quite successful in the beginning of the 17th century because of the spice trade, the pepper and the cloves and the nutmeg and so on, and these were basically acquired not by trade but by expropriation, which is somewhat of a taxation, I would say. So this whole exchange between Asia and Europe, well, often is not a way of trade only or pure trade only. It is power politics are very important. For instance, if you have the cloves, the population in a certain area is just obliged to grow the cloves for the Dutch, and they take it in their warehouses and they ship it away. And in cinnamon, there are almost the same kind of things. If you look at nutmeg, it's a monopoly trade. So the people deciding in the end on the quality are a sort of civil servant people rather than merchants in the way we think they are. They often have the title of merchant, but they did something else.
Yes. No, yes, that's a good point. Sylvia?
The companies didn't only market or buy for themselves, but they, at least in the case of the Dutch East India Company, they kept an eye on the competition. And I know that the French were doing particularly well. I think it was either Porcelain or Lacquer, and they ordered, we want what you are delivering to the French. Mm-hmm. So it's not what the Dutch wanted, but it was what the competition was selling well.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to keep an eye on the competition.
Mm-hmm.
And regarding the orders, it also depends on who is producing it. Like in the case of lacquer, Japanese lacquer, the Dutch had the monopoly, of course, but you have to look at the producers, that they are not accustomed to making objects, furniture, that are not suitable for the domestic market. So they need a sample, they need a drawing. And if they don't have that model or the drawing, they can't produce it because the measurements would be incorrect. So it's often that it's not so much the company who orders particular things, but it's also the maker who decides what is being produced. And it's the company always asked for curious.
Yeah.
It didn't matter what it looked like, as long as it was rare of curious.
Yes. So they have variety and curious senses of the code words
blinking.
Yeah. Have you, in your work on lacquer, have you come across correspondence between, like, how much can you see of orders and, I mean, besides from curious and that, can you expand a bit on that? On
well, if it's for the Asian markets, which we haven't discussed, for the Dutch market, it's the individuals, the private traders, private individuals, who are the trendsetters.
Yes.
So when they're doing well in the Netherlands, and the company says, we want that.
Yeah.
It's not the company deciding what. But when it's for the Asian markets, which have particular demands, like when it's for Muslims, it shouldn't have human figures or animals, especially owls or pigs. They will say what kind of decoration they want. But for the European market, it didn't matter as long as it was curious. And for the Asian markets, they would also send drawings of particular plants and flowers that they wanted. We don't have those drawings, but I know that they wanted particular designs.
For the Asian market.
For the Asian
market,
yes.
I think, Maxine, you're next on the list.
Well, partly Cynthia's taken up some of those issues, but I'll just carry on with that. I did want to, to see if there was a way we could bring in some more discussion of the orders for porcelain, and unfortunately Anna has just gone away. I don't know if she's coming back or what. Yes, yeah, that's right. But you can start us off, Cynthia. It's I think what the point you make about the sending the shapes, the designs, etc., for making things for these very different kind of cultural markets is a really important one. And it's very interesting, the distinction you draw between those Asian markets, where there's very particular demands, and these European markets, where you're saying, actually, maybe the demands weren't so particular, something curious and something rare, but we do know that there's certainly, we have to look at the change over time with those porcelain markets. Getting a tea bowl becomes replaced with getting a tea cup, and some of those designs will change, etc., that we get demands sent for that. I wonder, you have a specialist knowledge of Deshima, and perhaps you might say something about those kinds of orders placed for the Japanese porcelain, for the porcelain produced in Arita, and maybe something about the lacquer too, because the use of this lacquer, how that gets incorporated into European, just how they used it, and what kinds of pieces they asked for, those furniture makers, what they do with it, so all of that, it's an area we know less about. So those are kind of areas of topics. And I just, one on another point, just on a lot of these topics, I think we've got more questions than we can ever provide answers for, but it does ask us to try to think creatively about the kinds of sources that we might look to find some of these answers. So I think it would be really great if we could have some discussion of the different kinds of sources that people are using in their, their different archives and their different historiographical contexts that they come from. So there's those two areas, one on porcelain and lacquer, and one on sources. Okay, so perhaps you could start us off, Cynthia.
That's really difficult because I'm a slow thinker. Concerning the porcelain, when the Dutch trade in porcelain really started off in the 1630s, because then they had easy access to Taiwan.
Yes.
I remember that what they were buying was what the Chinese were supplying.
Yes.
And at a certain point, of course, they asked for certain things, but they were, the designs were more of Dutch houses and Dutch scenery.
Yes.
And the directors in the Netherlands wrote, "We don't want those, we want designs that are curious." So it has to be related to China.
Yes.
It shouldn't be anything European.
Mm.
The shapes are European because, of course, the Europeans have to use it. But the designs should always be curious. So when the trade in porcelain stopped in the 1640s, they had to find different outlets, and they went suppliers, and they went to Persia, and they went to Japan.
Yeah.
But the type of design was still the type that the Chinese had been supplying, which is the crack, divided into panels and whatever.
Yes.
So the Japanese were producing crack style porcelain, but it was Japanese. And later on, they started developing different designs, the multicolor, the red and orange and gold, which was an imitation of, They designed that, and then the Chinese, when the Chinese came back into the market, they copied the Japanese, imari. Mm-hmm. But still, it always had to be curious. Mm. It's not that they wanted something that resembled any European design. So I don't know about the Cantonese production, because those are more European.
Yeah.
So there may be different...
Yes, that's very interesting. Any points on lacquer?
On lacquer.
The expert on lacquer is here. We need to hear from her.
In the case of lacquer, the Dutch followed the Portuguese. So the Portuguese were the first in Japan. They started ordering lacquer. And it's in a so-called Namban style, which is the southern barbarian style, which is... very crowded, and it has mother of pearl and gold, but it's a very dense decoration, leaving little spaces open. Yes. The Dutch started buying that, also the English for the 10 years that they were there, and it's one of the arguments that I have with other authors on this topic is that they say this is the Iberian taste.
Yes.
And I don't agree with that, but it takes too long to discuss that. When the Portuguese left, the style changed into what they call the Como style, which is the Dutch style, which is the black, spaces of black lacquer with gold decoration. Mm-hmm. And that is the most familiar type. Like we have in Copenhagen, and in Victoria and Albert, and wherever, country houses, you see these cabinets with black lacquer cabinets with the gold decoration. Mm. Now, people say that this is Dutch taste. Now, I disagree. Mm-hmm. It's Japanese taste. Mm. It's not the Dutch ordering Dutch taste. They are ordering what the Japanese are supplying. So, again, this is a case of Western styles, the object is a Western object, but the decoration is Japanese.
Yeah.
Is that sufficient?
Yeah.
We might pump you a bit more of a conversation.
Yes. You missed out on this conversation, Anna, but we were trying to have some discussion about the supplying of these different markets in porcelain and lacquerware, and there's all this discussion of orders for the curious and rare, and so to what extent Chinese, Japanese designs are actually asked for shapes in European patterns, but the designs being dominantly Chinese designs. How much are those designs altered? I don't know if you have any.
Sorry, I missed it. I had
just to throw a spanner in the works with this. Yes. There must come a point, it'd be very interesting in household inventories, the values given to lacquerware coming in and that given to homemade Japanning, which is a cheap alternative.
That's right.
But it may be a case like the difference between silver and Sheffield plate, that actually Sheffield is seen as a novelty in its own right, it has its own aesthetic value. So the relationship between that which is imported, which is exotic and curious, and that which is actually made as an imitation of it.
Yeah.
And so what are the different values between the two as assigned? Mm. So why would you buy lacquer? Why would you buy Japan work? Two totally different, they look totally different to our eyes, but in fact have this similarity. So, why would you want to have lacquer? Is it much, much more expensive to import lacquer and buy it as against Japanware? I don't know, this is just the substitution.
I don't know about the prices. But the quality of Japanese lacquer is superior.
Oh, it's hugely superior. But that doesn't mean people don't value what's actually quite naff. It's just in terms of what it
is. Just a minute. I think to could add, I don't know if Anna has anything to add first before we go to Georgia.
From the way we were talking, the terminology is confusing. Cynthia and I have talked about on other occasions, particularly in English, right? We're Japaning and Japan in the same terms as China and porcelain. And that makes it much easier in some ways to use the Dutch sources, because it's much clearer what you're talking about. But what is identified as what? Japanese taste? What is that exactly? I'd like to hear more from what you think, but I think these are very fluid concepts that are very much influenced by perceptions of what the other expects they want.
It's so like saying Indian taste. If you say, actually it's Chinoise, it's Chinese. It doesn't actually, it just means something exotic. I'm curious, what does curious mean? Can we define?
Well, exactly. Curious is a very problematic term.
Which you've just been talking about.
But also,
it's pinning down exactly what that means in terms of translating a design demand and how liberal you can be in interpreting that on both sides, both in terms of what you're asking for and also what you're going to make and bring over.
So I just don't think there are clear boundaries between these things. So with porcelain, they often talked about Chinese taste and export ware taste, and those are now seen to be much more fluid. Not so much in terms of the quality, that's clearly distinguishable, but who wanted it and who were consumers for it is much more mixed, and there are markets for the whole range, both in China and outside. I mean, now lots of archaeological work is finding what we would call export-type porcelain, but in Chinese graves, which is changing the picture. That's very substantial.
Georgia.
I was reflecting on what Cynthia was saying. I don't think I've ever found any reference to textiles being described as curious in terms of pattern. And this might be because textiles are not final products. I mean, apart from the palampores, but later on, when you move in the 18th century, textiles are really raw materials to produce something else. Sometimes there is the import of Finnish shirts and so on, but the majority of it, and we know that it's a large chunk, surely the English trade and also the French trade, are really textile to do something else, in which central will be the patterning in that case, the design applied to the textile. The other thing that has not come out, it is central again to textiles, is the state regulations on products. In this case, you will have textiles in which they compete to, and eventually other cotton textiles produced at home, which are subject to very precise regulation. And I don't know how much, with the creation of home industry in Japan, in porcelain, and so on, they will have to conform to certain regulations. Because textiles, of course, are such an important industry in Europe, there are very precise regulations in terms of length, in terms of the quality of the dyes and so on, and also imported products, once in those cases in which they are really circulated, and conform to those regulations. Now we have the noise.
Maybe we better shut the windows. They will cut the grass now.
It's a motorbike.
Oh, it's a motorbike. Okay, it's just a motorbike. It'll go away.
No, I think if that's a valid point, Giorgio, and I've been thinking about what Spike talked about, warehouse and all that, and variation that you said is one of the main sort of ways, and that ties in with a lot of what we saw in these East India order books, like more of it, more variation. That's the variation is where really the demand is coming in, but also about warehouses and how much you can stock and how much you can sell, and coming in with a small East Indian company. When was the Swedish East Indian company? When did they start having their own proper warehouses? Sometimes in the 50s, isn't it?
You mean in Gothenburg?
Yeah.
Yes, it's the house was built in the 50s, quite late.
Yeah.
They were selling in houses around the town.
Exactly. I think I had a slide off that you can say this is for on display in so-and-so's house. And obviously then you had to sell everything. And then you have to have it, it has to move, you know. Yeah. While in London, they had, you know, quarterly sales. And that must also have made a difference to what they could stock and how they were selling. Felicia?
Just very quickly, I mean, it's kind of a banal point, but it's something that I think we tend to forget, is that, yes, textiles in a way weren't finished goods, but a lot of the lacquer that was imported, and even the porcelain, weren't finished goods either. And that if, I mean, Caroline Sargentson's the one who's done most work with that I know of in France, that even kind of very obvious things that we would think go together, like a plate and maybe another plate, or a vase, they just cut the top off the vase and stick a plate on and make it into an urn. And even the lacquer, they would take off the actual lacquer off the wood and stick it onto a French commode. So the idea of what we talked about before, kind of raw material versus finished products, is, I think, really fluid, and it's something that we shouldn't underestimate.
Yes, another point in terms of classifying imported goods, which in the sense at the end of this project I would welcome a much stronger sense of, is the difference between what the companies always define as being fine goods and gruff goods.
Mm-hmm.
The gruff goods being the cheap, the disposable, the everyday, and that includes some things that are customarily classified as being fashionable goods. Mm-hmm. So there are categories of Indian textiles that come under the gruff heading and are disposable. Nankin cloth is another good example there, where it's used for all sorts of production of cheap clothing and so on. And what I've never really been able to get a strong sense of is the proportionate distribution within incoming cargo between fine and gruff, or if you like, luxury goods and the more disposable ordinary. And I suppose in a sense, our view of it now is a little bit distorted by the fact that so much that has survived is of the fine category, whereas the gruff has more or less disappeared. I don't think I've ever seen any Nankin cloth in this country, and yet very large quantities of it were produced. We know that most of it went into making cheap pairs of trousers for sailors and so on.
They do have a couple of examples in the DNA, so you can actually go and see it.
I think we'll talk a bit more about that. And Chris, Sherry, you've been talking about fine, rough stuff. that's something definitely I think we've been thinking about too.
It's my second part of my question. Nobody's been addressing it.
Oh yeah, sources.
Okay. To look at. I mean, we had this wonderful source that John Stiles explored in the Foundling Museum and the exhibition of the Foundling Hospital as a source for finding out about textiles. Mm. I just want to open it up about, say a little about sources.
Two easily accessible ones in the British case would certainly be the online newspaper collection, the Burnley collection, the adverts there that are really ripe for systematic study.
Mm.
And somebody mentioned the Old Bailey proceedings online, there's a lot of good stuff there about pilfering and very good descriptions of things in there.
Perhaps couple that with a straightforward probate income. Bearing in mind that they last longer in certain parts of the country than others.
Nick?
Well, being one of the museum representatives, and I was actually going to say this when you asked the question, I've seen, of course, the things themselves. I know it's a different task to use them as sources, but it's not impossible. It does tend to you have to be a little bit careful to get it on the same level of use, but you can do it, and you need of course profound empirical knowledge, but it is possible, and to use the artifacts themselves as we have in the museums and also private owned. Seems to me to be obvious, and there's of course those linked to both probate inventories after a deceased persons, but also after and which is in this case perhaps more important in the tournaments after bankruptcies, where you usually see both what they have in their houses and what they have in their warehouses and in the shop around the corner. But to get an idea of what this actually means in all these small lists of whatever, written perhaps by somebody who didn't know the difference between Japanese lacquer and European lacquer. You need to know the artifacts and so on.
I think you have to be careful. We're talking, we're both part of another project which is called East India Company at Home, which is looking at these East India Asian goods that come into Western homes, you want to be the other way around. And it's the sort of what I should call the National Trust problem. It's about a house that you go into and you know it's furnished in 18th century furniture. You think, fantastic, you know, there's Asian goods that are 18th century. In fact, they've been bought in about circa 1972 and and it's sort of like it should be. But that's a very subjective sort of thing. That's very different from a chair which you can actually trace to an inventory you know, that was made in 1762 and bingo, you've actually got the object that matches actually the description that's made in the inventory. And then quite very, then it's a whole other stage to then take it back to what, how it's described within a private trade, you know. So it's you could be very careful with these generics because we can be very sloppy with the language and sloppy in how we think what these things are. But that's not to say that we're not going to be doing that, but it's a caution.
What we're finding is there are objects that have been passed down that the provenance is clear on. So there are examples that
are
safe to use and that will be helpful in that kind of definition and actually finding out about what these things are and what they
Do. Yeah, Felicia and Leos and Jana?
Jesus, just an example of... why teaching is quite important, but I had I was just had the almost the exact conversation, but on a slightly different level with second year undergraduates yesterday, and looking at a range of different sources, saying how can you do kind of history of consumption from that, and what they quite liked and what I hadn't thought is that they still, because they aren't properly trained, if you like, they aren't properly trained as historians who want to go to archives or as kind of curators who want to look at objects. They're quite happy to look at all different things, and it's they like looking at literature, for instance, which and obviously I have to say that I've got I come from literature at some point, but there is something in travel writing and in literature that is really useful that you don't get from say inventories, is that you know how people react to the things, and even if it's like Evelina going a shopping, right, you, or the female Tetler describing a visit to the India house, it gives you an idea that is really quite useful. And the other is, for instance, printed sources that I really enjoyed, well, generally visual sources and caricatures, as well as just the kind of, you know, Ackermann's repository and all these kind of things, where you get an idea of how the things were actually used in an everyday context, how they were placed and where they were placed. And that's why I think it's nice to have cross-disciplinary in the way that David Porter talked about when he was here, that you can really use different types of sources for this kind of thing. And it would be, I think, very much in favour of moving away from just one kind of source, but putting them together.
Do you think there's a danger as well there that I kind of want to flag up, that once again you get the problem with the generic rather than ever the specific? So you get a generic idea of how people react to chinoiserie or China without ever really knowing what that means in substantial terms, in terms of what are those objects actually in. At least to some point get down to specific, I would argue as well at the same time. So they need to be backing up there.
If you want to know where the specific one was placed on a mantelpiece or maybe on a table, if you look at lots of kind of visual images, it might give you an idea.
We have Leos.
Talking about sources, so I mean, inventories have been already mentioned as a very good source, and I just recently came across a reference. I mean, inventories were used in Sweden for studying of porcelain, for being tea drinking and coffee drinking, entered houses. But quite recently, I saw reference to a work on archaeological excavations of porcelain, following exactly the same thing. So how porcelain penetrated ordinary households, and I mean archaeological sources is not only about what you find on the land, but also chips, you know, red chips, can be quite interesting. When Felicia mentioned literature, so travel accounts are actually very good in tracing these consumable things that you can't really find in there are archaeological places. I found a really marvelous quote about differences between tea and coffee drinking cultures in Gothenburg and England. So you can find a lot there. But I'm an also.
Spread the word.
Another note on sources. University of Cape Town and the National Archives of South Africa, which has a branch in Cape Town, has done detailed work on material culture. Mm. And if you look at them online, they have inventories of several Europeans who started off from various parts of Asia to come to Europe to settle down, but were either sick or because they couldn't depart, couldn't bear to leave their wife and children behind, they couldn't bring them further away from South Africa into Europe, decided then to live in Cape Town. So they have a very, very strong culture of research on people culture. And if you follow the works of Nigel Penn and Nigel Warden,
could you say those again, please?
University of Cape Town. Nigel Penn, N-I-G-E-L-P-E-N-N, and Nigel Warden, W-O-R-D-E-N. They have looked a lot into societies of Cape Town as well as material culture.
Yeah.
But specifically the archives of Cape Town. They have online inventories of various European homes in Cape Town. Goods from the Malay world, the Chinese world, the Indian world, many cabinets, everything which was meant to be in Europe, but for some reasons ended up
in Cape Town. Very interesting.
Great.
In terms of a complete data set, it would be the Mark Warburton study of Cornwall and Kent, in which the book only publishes some of the findings, but they were complete transcriptions. So the problem. Yeah. Large sample of inventory is incredibly time consuming to do it, but it's already done, and I know it is very keen for other people to use the database.
Does he have this database online, or is it just have to write
online,
to him?
There's also for lazy people a lot of North American kind of 17th and 18th centuries inventories online that are searchable.
And a word of warning about models, something that I guess went a long way, but the idea, you know, when I was working on 18th century sort of making, particularly in silver, you think, oh, well, there'll be models. How did they transfer design information? We think, there are those models and designs that are lurking there, that are waiting to be found, but actually one has to think about the design process, actually, how you go from idea to the finished product. Mm-hmm. And in many cases, although it's done by eye, you don't need a model or a design. It's done from an object directly to another object. You don't have to go through a written paper design process or a model design process. And okay, yes, it's thousands of miles away, but you can take one object, one piece of porcelain from here to China, and it can be copied. I mean, the other way around. I mean, you don't necessarily need the mediating steps of models and paper to do that. I mean, you can, and they do survive, but you know, it's not necessary. We underestimate how a craftsman works, and that you know, turning one thing into another thing, into a copy. So,
The entire.
Go on.
No, I know in the case of the Japanese, because it's not only one person supplying it, so if the person who has to make it next year doesn't have this model or the design, he wouldn't know how to do it. Mm-hmm. So they do need it. And when it gets lost, which I found references to, that it's either in Kyoto where the lacquer is made, or it's in Nagasaki, they left it behind in Nagasaki, we can't make it. We need the model.
That may be something about its unfamiliarity as well. Yeah. But then the language of sort of describing something and being familiar with something or not.
I think Andrew Stritch.
It was just on sources. The entire All Wills Registry and All Scottish Commissary and Sheriff Courts including the inventories and probates, and there's over 1.5 million of them or something. From 1500 to 1900 are all available and searchable. So if you wanted in porcelain or bring up, so you would get a sale. It's just Scottish Wills Online. It's all commissary and sheriff court. If they died and they wanted to intestate under law, you'd have to then produce an inventory of the individual goods.
Right. We started a bit late, so I think we can. I think we need to draw an end here and move on to a bit of coffee. Or is that fine, Maxine? Or did you want to add something?
No, I have nothing. Are we missing anyone? Did anybody have a final point to make before we break?
I think it's more hands. Okay. Seen, but since this was
a break.
So we will. Shall we then move it up forward a bit? Or should we just have 20 minutes break? Maybe just 20 minutes.
Okay.
Back here. Free party.
Okay. Good. Thank you. That was good.